WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. Scientists are giddy about a recent development on a planet called K2-18b. The Texas Senate just acquitted Attorney General Ken Paxton of what looked like purely politically motivated charges, and one carbon capture pipeline company just announced a major setback. We have these stories and more coming up. But first, have the elites decided to erase our borders without telling the rest of us? It wouldn't be surprising. Border Patrol agents are busing illegal aliens within the interior of the U.S., and Republican donors are developing shanty towns the size of Washington, D.C., for illegal aliens who are in the U.S. Over the weekend, the Daily Wire published an investigative report revealing that just north of Houston, Texas, there exists a 60-square-mile development filled with illegal aliens. Colony Ridge is home to anywhere between 50,000 to 70,000 people. It's also a place where frequent Mexican cartel activity is highly suspected. Colony Ridge is exploding in population, and it's filled with half-built homes, dilapidated trailers, and heaps of trash. Daily Wire, which was on the scene, reported that, quote, houses on the ground fly the flags of foreign countries and many homes display their addresses on spray-painted pieces of plywood. Many structures, some of which are not hooked up to running water, were under construction, while others were unfinished but didn't appear to be actively getting worked on. At least one plot of land didn't have any structures at all, just a tent in the corner nestled between shrubs, end quote. Colony Ridge is a place where illegal aliens can buy land deep in the heart of Texas. Todd Brentsman, a national security fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies, said buyers can bypass normal requirements, including the need for a social security numbers. Buyers at Colony Ridge can pay as little as a few hundred dollars as a down payment. They're likely to pay high interest rates, near 15%, but it's not a bad deal if you're here illegally. The loan comes directly from the developer. Colony Ridge is owned and operated by developer William Trey Harris. According to campaign records, Harris is a Republican donor. Chris Russo, the president of Texans for Strong Borders, told the Daily Wire there are some serious allegations that Republican politicians are involved in the development. Russo pointed to Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott, who has taken $1.4 million in political contributions from Trey Harris. According to records, Harris's wife also donated $100,000 to Abbott's campaign in 2018. Her occupation is listed as Colony Ridge Development. And meanwhile, in San Diego, California, Border Patrol agents are following in the footsteps of their counterparts in Tucson, Arizona, and releasing hundreds of illegal border crossers onto American streets. This is happening because there's no room for the daily deluge of illegals. Fox News video footage shows hundreds of migrants, including many from places like China and Pakistan, being let out of buses and dropped off inside the U.S. One video clip captures a Border Patrol agent telling a migrant that he can go wherever he wants in the U.S. Here's Bill Belugin of Fox.
Border Patrol simply cannot keep up with the sheer volume of people crossing our border illegally right now. Every day this week, they've had more than 7,000 apprehensions of illegal immigrants. And we want to show you what these mass releases look like. Take a look at this video out of San Diego yesterday afternoon. What you're looking at is three unmarked white Border Patrol buses. They pull up and they start releasing several hundred illegal immigrants to city streets and sidewalks in San Diego across from a transit terminal. People were on this bus from as far away as China and Pakistan. And keep in mind, these buses are not from Texas. They're not Greg Abbott's buses. These are the Biden administration's buses. This is Border Patrol mass releasing people. You can see handfuls of them are standing around not knowing where they are, what to do, where to go next. And there was a remarkable exchange between one migrant and a Border Patrol agent as he asked the agent, hey, am I okay to travel to Chicago? And the agent says, yep, you're good to go. Take a listen.
You're free to go anywhere you want. You're free to.
Okay, it's no problem if I go to Chicago.
Anywhere you want. You're free to.
And these mass releases also taking place in Border Patrol's Tucson, Arizona sector. We shot this video in Sierra Vista, Arizona yesterday afternoon. A Guatemalan family dropped off by Border Patrol in a Dollar Tree parking lot, just a random store parking lot. They didn't know where they were. They didn't know what to do. And the local sheriff out there says these mass street releases aren't fair to the community. They're not fair to the migrants.
Jeremy discussed today's stories as executive senior editor of the New American Magazine, Steve Bonta. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Paul.
So I really, it seems like they already made these decisions to basically destroy the borders, and we're kind of like the last to get the memo. I mean, what else can all this mean?
Well, this affects me on a personal level. It really infuriates me because my wife is a foreign national. She is in another country right now, waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting to get, you know, the stuff, all the required materials processed, which I submitted on her behalf months and months and months ago. And we're given to understand that it may be a good 2 to 3 years yet before she is able to legally immigrate to the United States. Okay. And this is a...
Is that because of slow-ups on our part here in the U.S.?
That's because the government slow walks and does not prioritize people who are actually, including spouses. I mean, there's a widespread misapprehension out there that, well, if you're married to an American, of course, you automatically should be able to move to the United States. That is not true. It was true at one time. It is no longer true.
Yeah.
And so all of those of us who are trying to go through or who have family members who are trying to go through this process legally, generally, you know, have to retain lawyers to the, you know, immigration lawyers to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars, and or get your local congressman to, which, you know, eventually I'm probably going to have, I can't afford an immigration lawyer, but I, you know, may have to contact. Well, in theory, if you're the spouse, you're the sponsor, right? But we'll probably ultimately a year from now, when we still haven't heard anything, probably have to contact, you know, the congressman, and then he'll have to, you know, that's one of the things congressmen do. You know, this whole most Americans are blithely, who aren't part of this, you know, are blithely unaware of how very difficult it has become
to go
even
legally
for spouses and close family members to come to the United States legally. And the same can be said, mutatis mutandis, of companies that are trying to bring in, you know, highly skilled foreign workers. This sort of thing, it's just visas are getting more and more, and let alone green cards, more and more and more difficult to obtain. Meanwhile, it turns out that if you're willing to show up at the southern border and wade across the Rio Grande, well, okay.
You get bus wherever you want. You want to go to Chicago?
Yeah.
Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's absolutely disgusting.
What do they have to gain? What, I mean, I know this has been an issue, and I guess almost a fact for many years. But what do Republican donors or any donors or elitists gain from all this illegal immigration?
Well, I don't know the details, but I'm sure it ultimately comes down to money. You know, where there's money to be made, people will be happy to take advantage of it. And this, you know, this points up the, you know, the amorality of our system is that, you know, I mean, if for example, if our government says, you know what, you can go and trade with an odious regime, a communist regime or whatever, and make money, that's fine. They'll go ahead and do that. They will not be generally encumbered by saying, well, maybe I shouldn't be going over there and building. And same with this immigration. We have the country literally falling apart. It's being deliberately engineered, but there are people who will say, well, if there's money to be made, you know, if I can get government grants to build a ginormous housing development in the middle of Texas or whatever, I'm sure there's government money involved.
You think so?
And subsidies. Absolutely.
Well,
yeah, you know,
it certainly sounds at least predatory. I mean, the guy's charging 15% interest rates.
He's sort of a microcredit entrepreneur. Ironically, the guy, what, Muhammad Yunus, I think his name is, the guy from Bangladesh that pioneered the microcredit movement and won a Nobel Prize for it, he's now in trouble with the law because it turns out that he's basically, you know, did the same sort of thing. You know, he offered small loans to people who weren't credit worthy otherwise, but it turns out the same kind of predatory practices. So sure, no doubt, as with these other sorts of loan related skullduggery, some government, whether it's the government of Texas, the federal government, is probably backing him up, you know, and saying, you know, well, don't worry, you're doing a service for the country, and we'll support you. And if the loans go bad, we'll cover, you know, those sort of thing. People don't make loans to guys living in shanty towns unless they have some assurance.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. I mean, the report that we read, and maybe we could look into this, is the government funding this? Because that would certainly be interesting. One thing we didn't mention, because we're out of time, is there has been serious crime over there, and there's serious suspicion of cartel activity, which I did mention. But anyway, there's a whole lot going on. We need to take a break, and we will be right back with the Ken Paxton news.
In 1988, the John Birch Society produced a documentary so predictive, it's as though they had a time machine. Out of Control, Immigration Invasion was produced and hosted by investigative reporter William F. Jasper and looks at the growing problem of unrestricted illegal immigration that, in 1988, already saw upwards of 10 to 20 million illegal aliens within the borders of the U.S. Unknown agents from around the world using the southern border as easy entry. Certainly, some are innocent families escaping hardship, but also certainly some are criminals, potentially terrorists. Is it not appropriate that there be some criteria for the entry of any sovereign nation? Why should the U.S. be different than Canada, Germany, Russia, Japan, or every other country on the planet? Out of Control, Immigration Invasion. Watch this time capsule of prescient wisdom at thenewamerican.com/out of control.
Welcome back to The New American TV. We're going to stick around in Texas for our next story. The impeachment and recent acquittal of Texas Attorney General Paxton is another illustration of weaponized politics. It's also a reminder that justice can still prevail. On May 27th, the Texas House voted to impeach Paxton on charges involving corruption and bribery. The vote was a lopsided 121-23, despite the fact that most members of the House are Republicans and Paxton is a fellow Republican. In fact, among the Republican members of the House, more than 70% voted to impeach. Now, contrast that with the votes the Texas Senate cast on Saturday to acquit Paxton. 30 senators, 18 Republicans, and 12 Democrats voted on each of the 16 articles of impeachment. The vote to convict failed to even get a simple majority, let alone the two-thirds majority required. And at most, only two Republicans voted to convict on any of the articles. So why were the vote tallies in the Texas House and Senate so different? Well, the Senate followed due process and looked at the evidence before voting. But in the House, there was a rush to judgment. After Saturday's votes to acquit, Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who's also president of the Senate and president at the trial, made this point.
In the House, the vote to send the articles of impeachment against the Attorney General to the Senate happened in only a few days, with virtually no time for 150 members to even study the articles. The Speaker and his team rammed through the first impeachment of a statewide official in Texas in over 100 years while paying no attention to the precedent that the House set in every other impeachment before. In the past, the House had transparent and open investigations for all to see, including other House members. The target of the investigation was notified and invited to attend with counsel and given an opportunity to cross-examine witnesses that were placed under oath before testimony was taken. At the conclusion of past House investigations, the evidence was laid out for weeks for House members to evaluate, not hours, before they took their vote on articles of impeachment. Representative John Smithy, a longtime House member who has argued cases before the Texas Supreme Court, spoke on the House floor during impeachment vote in May. He was one of only 23 who voted against impeachment. Representative Smithy said the House could not legitimately impeach General Paxton on the record because there was no record to send to the Senate. He said the House was not following the rule of law. He said the House approach, and I quote Representative Smithy, hang them now and judge them later.
The Lieutenant Governor recommended listening to Representative Smithy's speech after the impeachment several months ago. Here's a small part of it where he discusses the claim that the House was supposed to operate as a grand jury.
You've heard this compared to a grand jury proceeding, and in some ways it's like a grand jury proceeding, and in other ways it is not. But I can tell you this, that no grand jury can legitimately indict any individual, any potential criminal defendant, without evidence. You can't indict without evidence, period. And what you're being asked to do today is to impeach without evidence.
The rush to judgment by the Texas House resulted in AG Paxton's automatic suspension from office. This injustice was not corrected until Saturday's acquittal. So why did Republican politicals join forces with Democrats to try to get Paxton out of the office to begin with? There's a war in the Republican Party, and Paxton is on the wrong side, so far as the neoconservative wing of the party is concerned. For instance, in 2020, Paxton filed a lawsuit alleging unconstitutional voting irregularities in four battleground states that Donald Trump lost: Pennsylvania, Georgia, Michigan, and Wisconsin. His suit was supported by 17 other AGs, but he also incurred the wrath of RINOs, as well as liberal Democrats and the major media. After Saturday's acquittal, Texas Governor Greg Abbott said in a statement, "Attorney General Paxton has done an outstanding job representing Texas, especially pushing back against the Biden administration. I look forward to continuing to work with him to secure the border and protect Texas from federal overreach." And Donald Trump put his two cents in on Truth Social. "Congratulations to the great people of Texas and the state Senate for rejecting political persecution and respecting the integrity of our elections." I'm going to bring Steve back in here. What are your thoughts on all this? It's clearly political, right, Steve?
Well, you know, as Pogo, the cartoon character, said a long time ago, we've met the enemy and he is us. So that's probably the most famous line from any cartoon ever. And it's really true. Because you want people like us who are pro-Constitution, pro-liberty, and so on, we want there to be some sort of, you know, repository, some partisan repository out there, some political tribe that represents us and what we stand for. And many of us include, well, the Republican Party, warts and all, that's their kind of that organization. But as it turns out, although there are a number of people, both at the state and federal level, in the Republican Party, you know, who are committed constitutionalists, mm-hmm. who are good people, some of them we've interviewed in our magazine recently, and this kind of thing. The party as a whole, as an organism, is at best bitterly divided, and at worst still controlled by this faction we call the RINOs, who, you know, newsflash, happen to control all the money, and happen to control a lot of the chairs and positions that really matter, you know, the national chair, the Republican committee, the people who lead in the, who are leaders in the Senate, like Mitch McConnell and so forth and so on. So, you know, that's what's going on. And what we're seeing in Texas is just a sort of microcosmic representation of this battle for the soul of the Republican Party, which has been going, or that moiety of the Republican Party that does have a soul, yeah. is trying to assert control over the moiety that doesn't. And, you know, this has been is not a new thing. It's been going on for decades.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Would you say that it's actually better now than it was, if for no other reason than the fact that we know that the Republican Party is an establishment party with no interest in preserving American and constitutional precepts?
Well, yeah, and I mean, the fact that we have this term RINO that everybody's familiar with now, which didn't exist, you know, 25, 30 years ago.
Republican in name only, in case.
Yeah, Republican in name only. It's like a rhinoceros without the H, okay? Yeah, so I mean, this is new terminology. It's quickly become standard. And so, you know, everybody kind of recognizes this reality. And that was not necessarily the case back in, say, the days of Ronald Reagan or Richard Nixon or Dwight D. Eisenhower. Even though if you look back at the history of those respective areas, you can also see this tension. You know, these people within the Republican Party who represent grassroots and constitutionalist and, you know, socially and religiously conservative elements that are routinely repudiated by these amoral RINOs that kind of sit at the helm of the party. Now, whether these insurgents, you know, the Freedom Caucus in the House and the people at the state level, like Attorney General Paxton, can actually effect a takeover of the party apparatus is an open question. I'm inclined to doubt that they can. I'm inclined to, because in the past, you know, prior to the modern day demo Republican duopoly that's obtained since the Civil War, there was a Democratic Whig duopoly, and the only and so obviously in those days there were people who sought to reform the Whigs from within, and it never came to fruition, and ultimately they had to found a new party, the Republican Party, which at least ostensibly in the beginning was committed to a set of moral values and was pristine and pure and all that. That didn't last very long, if indeed it was ever the case, which I doubt.
Some would argue that was ever the
case.
Yeah,
so I mean, you know, and then the question becomes, you know, should we have political parties at all? Obviously, the founding fathers were narrowly suspicious of mm-hmm. that. We don't have time to talk in depth about all of that. But I think that if it is the case, you know, if pragmatic reality dictates that we need a political party ultimately to effect lasting needed constitutional reforms in government, then it will have to be a new one. It won't be the Republican Party or the Democratic Party or anything like that.
Yeah, and there's been talk of that for so long. I guess the scary thing is that transition, because while you're forming a new party, what you're doing is you're possibly funneling votes and power from the party that has a best chance of representing our values.
Yeah, sure. And I mean, you know, and right now we're still in that phase where people are hopeful that the Matt Gaetzes and the
MTGs,
all these people, the Freedom Caucus folks Rampart, and their ilk, will be able to wrest control from, you know, the mainstream Republicans, so-called, whose basic goal is accommodationists. You know, to make sure the Republican Party stays on the defensive and is always ultimately accommodating the aggressive status goals of the socialists and Democrats. Or do I repeat myself?
Right. I think these stories alone illustrate how much the Republicans can't be trusted either. Thanks, Steve. Stay tuned, folks, because we'll be right back with the last two stories we got for the day.
The John Birch Society has been working tirelessly since 1958 to preserve freedom, safeguard the Constitution, and restore our God-given rights. We continually educate voters and lead the freedom movement. Join us as we work against a tyrannical one-world government. United as one, we can defeat this conspiracy against a free America. JBS founder Robert Welch said, "Education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon." Join us in restoring this great nation.
Welcome back. We have more good news from South Dakota, where a major carbon capture pipeline company is pulling up stakes. On Thursday, the Dakota Scout broke news that Navigator CO2 Ventures is suspending its pipeline plans in five eastern counties of the Mount Rushmore state, as well as several in northwest Iowa. According to that account, the company sent a letter to at least seven property owners along its proposed route that read, in part, "The project is getting shut down permanently. Negotiations are no longer on the table because the project is getting shut off." Republican State Representative John Hansen tweeted his delight over the news. He said, "The BlackRock-owned Navigator CO2 carbon sequestration pipeline is dead in South Dakota. We will not be robbed of our heritage by out-of-state foreign-backed companies. We will never stop defending our private property rights. Under God, the people rule." This latest news follows on the heels of the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission unanimously rejecting Navigator's bid to install a carbon capture pipeline in the state. Immediately after it said no to Navigator, the POC also denied another company's application to install a carbon capture pipeline. Up in North Dakota, Summit Carbon Solutions met unanimous resistance as well when that state's Public Services Commission denied its siting permit application. But the story's not over. Last Thursday, Navigator spokesman Andy Bates released a statement that makes clear they have no intention of completely giving up. He wrote, "As we are evaluating the next steps of permitting in South Dakota, we have paused some of our right-of-way work in certain areas, like South Dakota and some parts of Iowa, which has meant releasing a few of the land agent contract teams working on behalf of the project. The remaining land teams will be reallocated to ensure coverage across the footprint and continued conversations with landowners. Navigator remains committed to project development in a collaborative fashion and is continuing to work toward that goal." The pipeline companies have been confronted with intense resistance. A large part of that has come from the John Birch Society, whose members have educated citizens and elected officials and organized civil and effective resistance. And for our final story, is there life on other planets? The alien life form has become a science fiction cliche, but no one has proven that extraterrestrial life exists. Of course, not very long ago, no one could prove the existence of exoplanets either, because we didn't have any instruments powerful enough to check for planets around stars other than our own sun. Now, of course, science has cataloged thousands of exoplanets and has even learned to identify Earth-like planets that might harbor life. One of these planets, a possible watery planet called K2-18b, is several times the size of the Earth, and it orbits a red dwarf star about 124 light years from Earth. K2-18b is showing evidence that has scientists excited about the possibility of extraterrestrial life. That evidence is the presence of a certain gas, dimethyl sulfide. On Earth, this is only produced by organic life, specifically marine life like plankton. The discovery was made by the new James Webb Space Telescope, whose instruments are so fine that they can actually analyze the composition of the atmosphere of exoplanets as they transit in front of their star. Scientists are planning more imaging to confirm or negate the findings. Unfortunately, we won't be sending a spaceship to explore K2-18b anytime soon. 124 light years is about 744 trillion miles, a distance that would take our fastest spacecraft about 15 billion years to travel. All right, I'm gonna bring Steve back in here. So I had an idea, Steve. Maybe we should send the carbon capture developers to K2-18b.
Well, as I say, it would take them a very long time to get there.
But maybe they could develop that once they get there.
Sure.
No, they'd be dead by then. Anyway, what do you make of this? I know you were looking into this story.
What I make of what? The second story?
Yes.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, it's easy to forget. I mean, we all of our lives, we have seen, you know, in cartoons, in books, in movies, in TV shows, this universal trope of the alien, whether it's, you know, Marvin the Martian or a hostile xenomorph from the alien franchise, movie franchise, anything in between. This widespread assumption that there must be other planets like Earth out there. Now, when you and I were kids, we didn't even know for sure that there were planets outside of the solar system, because even the nearest stars are so far away that the task of directly imaging an Earth-sized or even a Jupiter-sized planet orbiting around, you know, a star, say, 10 light years away, was not feasible. But in the era of space telescopes, like the Hubble Space Telescope and now the James Webb, it's become marginally feasible to directly image large, you know, gas giants around some other near stars. But then they have other ingenious techniques that, starting back in the early 90s, for example, they can detect stars orbiting or planets orbiting around stars because they induce a gravitational wobble in the star. And even more interestingly, stars whose planet systems orbit more or less in a plane as observed from Earth will transit periodically the surface of the star. And so if we observe a star, they had a space telescope called the Kepler Space Telescope. Mm-hmm. It was launched back in the 90s that took light curves from, you know, hundreds of thousands of stars, and then enlisted people online to go through. I even did this for a while to look for drops in the light that would indicate some sort of dark body was passing between the Earth and that star. And in this way, they've cataloged thousands upon thousands of stars. And now they've refined their efforts. They've figured out how to tell approximately not only how massive the planets are that are thusly discovered, but more or less how near or far from the star they happen to be. And so they can start identifying, you know, exoplanets, as they're called, that are more or less like Earth, you know, in the habitable zone, or the Goldilocks zone, is sometimes called, not too hot, not too cold, yeah, a distance from the ideal distance from a star for fostering life, and possibly have water and so forth. So what the James Webb's telescope is now doing is it is using spectroscopy, meaning analyzing the light spectra coming from these stars, from these planets rather, when they transit their host star, to see what kinds of elements are in the atmosphere. Okay, so in this case, this particular planet, which doesn't even have an actual name, it just has an alphanumeric designation, is emitting this dimethyl sulfide, which here on the Earth only comes from one source. And not to put it too delicately, it's basically flatulence of marine life.
Okay.
Because marine life, just like us, eats food, digests it, and emits gas as a byproduct of the digestion.
Yeah. Okay?
And that happens to be dimethyl sulfide.
I didn't know marine life did that too.
Yeah, well, they believe they found evidences of this, and also methane and other things like this. But this particular compound is very telling, because science has never found it occurring in nature except as a byproduct of organic life.
Yeah.
Okay. Also, this planet appears to be somewhat larger than Earth, about eight times the size of Earth, but most likely is a water-covered planet. No, so oceans, life, plankton, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, it all kind of fits together. We don't know yet, but it's an interesting prospect.
Yeah. It reminds me of, I think there's a water planet in one of the Star Wars episodes where it's just purely water, and they develop civilization there. Obviously, they're always looking for a planet to others to inhabit. What do you think, Elon Musk? You think he has any ideas about?
I don't know. I mean, obviously, for some people, this has theological implications. There are people who, on a religious basis, believe that that God created only this earth for life to inhabit, and the idea of other worlds that also have life on them is perhaps anathema.
But this isn't the first time scientists have come out and said, "We think we found signs of life."
No. In fact, there was in a meteorite that originated in Mars back in the mid-90s during the Clinton administration. People came out and said, well, we think we've discovered fossilized microscopic worms or worm-like creatures in this meteorite. And indeed, there were these funny, long, sinuous shapes, you know, several microns long that were found that were embedded in this meteorite. And that actually prompted, I think, some sort of a special address from President Clinton at the time.
Yeah. It's and what since, became of it?
Well, what came of it is we're not sure. It kind of laid it aside, and you know, and this kind of thing. There have been other claims of evidence for either life now, microbial life now, or in the past on Mars. One of the first landers that landed there claimed to detect organic, substances, and this back in the 1970s. So it's still very much an open question.
Thank you, Steve. Well, folks, that's all for our news segment today. For more Truth Behind the News, make sure you get a subscription to the New American Magazine. You can do so online at thenewamerican.com, or you can call our office at 800-727-8783, Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time. Stay tuned, because after this, we'll be back with an interview from Alex Newman.
I certainly would not want a constitutional convention. I mean, whoa. Who knows what would come out of that?
Just imagine if we have a constitutional convention, the number of people who will be unhappy and the number of people who say the results are not valid, and then they'll just ignore the entire Constitution.
What we need are just more people that would read the one we have.
It isn't the Constitution that's the problem. It is the people who ignore the Constitution that usurp power and abuse the constitutional power that they ostensibly have.
If you can't enforce an existing piece of paper, how are you going to enforce a piece of paper that has a little more writing to it? In other words, it's been amended.
It's up to us to hold our elected officials accountable.
What can you do to elect good representatives and senators in your state legislature who understand the Constitution and are willing to take a stand?
Next up, the New American's Alex Newman interviews Swedish academic Jacob Nordengard about the planned convergence of technology and digitalization into a dystopian digital world brain that will end up dominating the entire planet if people don't stop it. You don't want to miss this.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Conversations That Matter. We have a very special guest for you today. He has been ahead of the curve on a lot of these issues, a brilliant Swede. His name is Dr. Jacob Nordengard, and he has a PhD in science and technology studies. He's a master of social science and geography and in culture and media. He has written a whole bunch of really, really important books. I actually have one of them. It's called Rockefeller, Controlling the Game. Extraordinary book. He's got a new one, a relatively new one called The Global Coup d'Etat, talking about some of the sustainable development goals and other things. And then actually the foreword to that is written by Catherine Austin Fitz. And then he's got a new one that hopefully is going to be published soon in English. And maybe it is in English already. And that is The Digital World Brain. Jacob, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for being with us. And I want to start with this digital world brain idea. We've heard the World Economic Forum. We've heard Klaus Schwab. We've heard going all the way back to, Alice Bailey talking about the coming one world brain, talking about this concept. But now the technological trends are converging to kind of at least make this theoretically possible. What do you mean by digital world brain, and what do we have to look forward to?
The digital world brain, I mean, it's the total digitization of everything. When everything becomes data, and the concept of the world brain, it comes from H.G. Wells. He wrote a book back in the 30s called The World Brain. And when I was dug into, I mentioned this in the Rockefeller book as well, with these ideas about creating a world brain in order to manage all affairs on the globe. because that's really what it's all about. The new technology that we have makes it possible to collect data from everyone. And H.G. Wells, he mentioned this is in a very old book from I think it's from 1899 or something like that. But he had it's called The Modern Utopia, the book, and a society where everything is collected about every person. And so it was a vision he had, and then we go forward to Zbigniew Brzeziński in 1970 in his book Between Two Ages. He also wrote about the possibilities and the future when it would be possible to have information about everyone instantly, anywhere, and about everybody's whereabouts. And now we are in a process of making this a reality. And this comes with United Nations new Our Common Agenda. Because when I studied this, it was very obvious that the end outcome of this was the creation of this digital world brain. And also, if we take Our Common Agenda, it was initiated in 2020, just after Klaus Schwab and Antonio Guterres and the now King Charles III declared the Great Reset. And this was United Nations' answer to this Great Reset. It wasn't, I mean, talked about at that time. I found out about this agenda in, I think it was some months after September 2021, when it was released, because they decided in 2020, we have to do something because of the pandemic. The member states, they said to the General Secretary Guterres, we need this report, we need this restructuring of the United Nations to make it more fit for the future challenges and future risks.
Fascinating. I want to dig into this Our Common Agenda. I've done some reporting on this. You know, they've got different components, different policy briefs that the Secretary General is putting out. One of them that I thought was pretty alarming is that we need these new global emergency protocols where basically the UN becomes all powerful over everything in the event that the Secretary General determines unilaterally that there's some sort of global emergency that doesn't have to be global and doesn't have to be an emergency. Fascinating stuff. But Jacob, I want to drill down a little bit deeper onto this global brain here. Do you think that with all this data that they're now starting to collect with the smart cities and with the surveillance of everything we're doing online, the surveillance capitalism, if you will, from Google and Facebook and all the apps, you know, what does that look like? I mean, I know the book you mentioned by Zbigniew Brzeziński, Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Age, he suggests that we're really going to have to totally reimagine government, totally reimagine the economy. And my friend Pat Wood has referred to this movement as really a movement for technocracy, where decisions are made by experts and scientists and really, I guess, computer programs and AI now under the guise of efficiency. What does a world governed by a world brain look like? Who programs this world brain? And how do our lives look different if we submit to this?
I mean, it's you don't have any the choices as we have today. I mean, it's a totally governed system, and that's the idea about this. It's about idea about creating a better society and a better human, and so, I mean, they decide. It's like we will have a scientific priesthood that decides upon the boundaries of the earth and how. What is sustainable and how much are you sustainable and how can we achieve this balanced world? I mean, I remember Al Gore, he had a book called Earth in Balance, and that's kind of what it is. And these top elite guys that themselves live lives that they fly all over the globe to tell other people how unsustainable they are. they will decide. They see themselves as the trustees for future generations. And even I know the World Economic Forum, they have this Davos Manifesto, and it was published first in 1973. And they talk about this: we are the trustees for the material universe for future generations. So they had decided it's better we run the world, and we, the peoples, we have to adjust to this.
What do you think motivates them, Jacob? Are they just really concerned about the environment? They're really concerned about the carrying capacity of the planet? Or do you think it's something more wicked?
Well, I think it's wicked. I guess some of them thinks we have to do this. We will do it better. It will be a better governed society for everyone in the end. We just have to go through this transition, and or more or less, it's like the idea they had in the Soviet Union to create the workers' paradise. We just have to crack some eggs before we get there. So I say some of these people believe in utopia, but. But for a lot of them, I guess it's power as well. I mean, it's they now have the means, they have the technology, they have everything to achieve this perfect society that they can govern. So I think that is what motivates them, and to be the ones that are the trustees. And actually, I mean, to have this system of control with an emergency platform and actually say that now we have an emergency, just push the button and all the actors all over the world just have to obey and follow the protocols. So, I mean, that is an old dream for a dictator.
What are the next steps? What comes next? We've got, of course, this SDG summit coming up in New York in September. Then we have, obviously, the Summit of the Future in 2024. What's the process of getting us from where we are today to maybe this world brain global system that they want to build? And what does that look like? How long do we have?
The thing is, we have this Summit of the Future in September next year. So, and in this September this year, they have this SDG summit, and then they will discuss, they have had all these policy briefs published about our common agenda. It started in March, and I think we'll publish the last ones, last two ones in the coming weeks. Then they will start to work with the outcome document. That they will have ready for Summit of the Future in September 2024. And they will then sign something called the Leaders Pact for the Future. And that is critical, because when we have that, and if they will bring in this emergency platform. So I said it's very, very important that we act within, I mean, it's 1 year that we have, that we really can act and protest and make people aware of it. Because what I find as a big problem is that I found out about this, our common agenda, in early 2022, I think. Because no one had mentioned it. It wasn't in media, and nobody talks about it. So, at the same time, United Nations, they have said they want people to be involved. I mean, they are so inclusive. Every voice will be respected in United Nations. Of course, if you have the wrong ideas, you won't. But I think it's very important just to inform people that this agenda exists and what it's all about, and that people start to act against it and talk. And I mean, of course, I guess some people will love this idea, but for those who think that freedom and democracy is important to protect, I mean, it's very important that we do something now.
There's more to this interview, including what can be done to stop the digital world brain. To listen to the entire interview, go to thenewamerican.com, click on video, then click on Conversations That Matter, and go to the Dr. Nordengard interview. We'll be back for more programming on the other side of this break.
Sophia paused before the door. It read, Department of Bi-Digital Convergence. Just inside was a new world, a better world, the one of everlasting life, of no pain, of no loss, of no problem. She entered the chamber and her surroundings changed. She saw around her an infinite field of waving golden grain surmounted by cloudless blue sky. The AI voice whispered gently in her mind, Welcome to the singularity. She couldn't see it and couldn't feel it, but her body had almost instantly been covered by a swarm of tiny gray multi-legged bots that melted through her clothes and into her skin. Not perceiving the nightmare, her eyes had already been consumed and the rest of her body was dissolving as the bots digested her flesh. She felt only a warmth suffusing her being. Drowsy, she drifted to sleep, and her last thought was one of panic. Would she ever wake? Could a nightmare vision like this be an outcome of the much-hyped transhumanist technological singularity? Enter the world of the future as illuminated by the experience of the past in Endgame, the new book by Dennis Barrett, the publisher of The New American Magazine, and find out how the disastrous COVID pandemic response fits with the technocratic elite's thirst to create a transhumanist utopia. Get Endgame from shopjbs.org with free shipping with code ENDSHIP, ENDSHIP. Or get Endgame and the Great Reset Collector's Issue of The New American Magazine and get free shipping plus an additional 20% off both with code END20, END20.
To complete today's show, Steve Bont and Gary Benoit continue their discussion of enumerated powers by diving into the few and specific powers delegated to the U.S. Congress by the U.S. Constitution. If Congress were to abide by the Constitution, the federal government would be much smaller than it is today, and there would be no need to continue borrowing massive amounts of money. Let's listen.
Hello, everybody. This is Gary Benoit, and we're here for another episode of Principles. And with me is Steve Bonta, the executive senior editor of the New American Magazine.
Hi, Gary.
Hi, Steve. Now, of course, Steve, in the last episode, we talked about the importance of the legislative branch, that being Article 1 of the Constitution and the powers being enumerated. And we touched a little bit on some of those powers, but not very much. So what I'd like to do right now is just go through these powers specifically, and they're listed in Section 8, Article 1 of the Constitution. And the first one is to borrow money on the credit of the United States.
Yeah.
Okay, and I don't know if there's a whole lot to say about that, but except maybe to say that the money that is spent should be spent for constitutional purposes. And if the money were spent only for what is constitutional, the budget of the United States would probably be 20% of what it is today.
Yes.
And so there wouldn't be a whole lot of need to borrow, would there?
Well, I mean, the point of the borrowing is, I mean, the assumption the founders had was that in times of peace, normal means of raising revenue, which for them was tariffs. We'll talk more about taxes and tariffs in separate, you know, separately. But their idea was that that you had to have the power to borrow money, controversial though it may be, because it can lead to debt, and we all know, you know, what the problems that can cause.
Right.
Because there's always a possibility of a national emergency, specifically a war. I mean, most wars, historically, probably all wars, have been funded by debt. You just can't get away from that. But the idea was that after a war is over, you pay off the debt. The reality, of course, is in the entire history of the United States, is that we've only been debt-free for a single year, I believe, mm-hmm. which was the year following when President Andrew Jackson paid off the American debt.
Which shows it can be done.
It can be done. But, yep. then the following year, they started borrowing money again, and that trend okay. has continued since
Let's,
then.
Let's continue going through some of these other specific powers. To regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. And, of course, that's a power that's really been misinterpreted.
It has, but it's one of the necessary, really necessary mm-hmm. powers. It's one of the reasons that the Constitution was created and was used to replace the Articles of Confederation, was this rather obvious issue that if we were going to be a single polity, a single country in mm-hmm. some sense of the word, that there needed to be a mechanism for resolving disputes among these, you know, semi-sovereign states.
Right.
And prior to the Constitution, the Articles of Confederation did not really provide for any such mechanism. So the federal government, the primary idea of limiting its power in the first place and leaving most of the reservoir of potential government power to the states or to the people themselves was this idea that there were certain things that the federal government could do that the states really couldn't do. And adjudicating disputes among the states was one of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And commerce.
Right.
It's the same thing.
Yep. To establish a uniform rule of naturalization and uniform rules on the subject of bankruptcies throughout the United States. And of course, that would include citizenship, naturalization.
Right.
And how do you have a nation if you don't have citizens?
Sure.
So you can see how that is a necessary power as well. The next one, to coin money, regulate the value thereof in a foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures.
Yes. Notice the term coin money. They
yes,
don't
I
say
know.
To print money.
They don't say paper money.
That's a story for another day in yes. more detail, but that is a very, yep. very significant, another significant departure from constitutional government is the existence of the paper money, the fiat
right.
money system that we have
in fact,
today.
On this basis alone, you could say the Federal Reserve System is unconstitutional.
You absolutely could.
Yep. Okay. To provide for the punishment of counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States. Boy, should the Federal Reserve be considered counterfeiters?
Sure.
But that's a subject for another day as well. To establish post offices and post roads.
Yeah.
To promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries.
Can I just interject?
That would be copyright.
Can I just interject something?
Sure.
I would counsel, you know, when the rare occasions when I go into a post office anymore,
mm-hmm.
I always treat post office employees with respect, even if they're a little bit sullen or whatever, mm-hmm. because they at least work for one of the few government agencies that is clearly authorized by the Constitution.
That's a really good point.
And yet people always love to pick on the post office and make fun
right.
of them as this horrible, inefficient bureaucracy, while at the same time upholding and extolling all these other government bureaucracies, of which nary a mention is made in the Constitution.
Right. And of course—
Support your local post office.
Yes, okay. But the fact that the Constitution does provide for a post office does not mean there cannot be competition.
Absolutely not.
And certainly we have that today.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's take a look at the next one. To constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court. And you know, see, what I find so interesting about that, and a lot of people don't realize this, is that the Supreme Court is the only court of the United States that's actually established by the Constitution. All other courts are established by Congress.
Right, and that implies that Congress is superior in authority to all those other, you know, subordinate
yeah.
courts,
yeah.
the circuit courts and so forth.
Absolutely. And so the next one, to define and punish privacies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the laws of nations.
I think you mean piracies.
Piracies, I'm sorry. Yeah. Piracies.
Which is similar perhaps to terrorism today
yep.
in some respects.
Sure, yeah. Look at it that way. To declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal.
That's one dog your
yep.
Constitution.
I know. And make rules concerning captures on land and water.
Sure. And, of course, we already mentioned in the previous episode, we talked about declaring war and how we don't do that anymore, despite mm-hmm. the fact that it's in the Constitution. Letters of marque and reprisal, very briefly, was the mechanism by which you authorize private entities, so-called mm-hmm. privateers, to act on behalf of government to, like, raid ships and so forth and conduct other, you know, minor military operations against an enemy power. And the idea was that this was a way to discourage full-blown war.
Right.
It was a little more stronger than diplomatic or economic pressure, but it fell short of actually declaring full-scale war on another country. And once upon a time, it was a fairly effective way to encourage countries to come to the negotiating table, rather than to erupt into a larger war at minimal damage.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
And unfortunately, we've done away with this system. There was a treaty, over 100 years ago, and we just agreed to do away with it. Of course, now conveniently, the United Nations system has sort of stepped in and takes care of all that.
Okay. The next several are very interconnected. Let me just go through those quickly. To raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for a longer term than 2 years. To provide and maintain a navy. To make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces, to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions.
Yes, indeed. Well, again, looking at that sensu stricto, you might say, well, they don't mention the Marines, they don't mention the Coast Guard, they don't mention the Air Force, much less the Space Force, so all these other branches of the military are of questionable constitutional legitimacy. I don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
I think so they're implied. In those days, right. The Army and the Navy, the land and sea power would today
include the Air Force.
Yeah,
so I
don't think that's it. But, there's a lot more we could talk about.
Right.
I think we're going to about run out of time today.
Very close. I do think it's interesting that the appropriation for the Army can not be for a period longer than 2 years.
It has to be reauthorized.
To make sure that Congress does not lose control of the executive branch and how the Army might be used.
And that's still the case today.
Absolutely. Well, we'll have to pick this up next week, Steve, but thank you very much. And next week, I think we'll spend a little more time on the executive branch.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of The New American TV. Remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. We'll see you tomorrow.